Thank you. First of all, I just would like to offer my condolences. I would like you to elaborate a little on you talked about the plan. This was planned in a military sense and planned in a propaganda sense. And I would like to ask you to elaborate on aspects of the way in which the propaganda side has been given expression in a couple of areas. First of all, I noticed that CNN and Reuters, among other major corporate media, used the term incursion repeatedly. Secondly, another reporter from the New York Times, you mentioned Ethan Bronner, Stephen Erlanger, who's reporting from Jerusalem, had a story reporting on what Israeli military sources had discussed with him, apparently, regarding people with weapons in Gaza, in civilian clothes, popping out of holes, and went into other details. And thirdly, there was interesting timing to me of a major front page feature story based presumably on timed leaks regarding Iran and Iranian, the fact that the Bush administration had supposedly said to Israel that they would not be authorized to fly over Iraq to bomb alleged nuclear facilities, but that instead the Bush administration were intensifying covert operations against those alleged programs in Iran. And finally, the interesting fact that Olmert supposedly spoke out against the occupation only weeks before launching this major invasion.
Okay, I'm not sure I got everything, but the meticulous planning of the invasion is discussed extensively in the Israeli press, and to some extent here too. So, and it describes both aspects, the military planning and the propaganda effort. And it's how effective it's been, you know, one could argue. There's one area where it's very effective in American elite opinion and in the press, but probably not among the population. The only poll I've seen shows the population very divided, roughly 50-50 on the invasion, despite the massive propaganda, which is just replicated almost without deviation in the media, including the examples you mentioned. As for reliance on Israeli military sources, well, of course, that's part of the propaganda system, it's kind of like the U.S. in Iraq, where reporters could go in if they were embedded, and meaning propaganda agents. And freelance reporters who tried to report, some of them were just dropped out of the corporate media. Others could do it as freelancers. In the case of Gaza, Israel has simply barred all reporters, foreign or it's even Israeli, because they want to make sure that there's no direct reporting. I mean, what you can get is, you know, cell phone calls or something like that, and reports from people like Matt Gilbert, this Norwegian doctor, and UN officials, and so on. That's all part of what they call their Hasbara campaign. Israel has two words, Hebrew, there are two words for propaganda. One of them is standard word for propaganda. The other, Hasbara, is for their own propaganda. And the word means explanation. The tacit assumption is that everything we do is so obviously right that all we have to do is explain it to people, and then they'll understand why we're actually exactly right. And that Hasbara campaign does work among American intellectuals and Western European intellectuals generally. As for the populations, it's an open question. I should say even on the rejectionism, although it's almost 100% supported by the educated sectors and the media and so on. Of course, it's not called that. The facts are always suppressed. It's not among the population. Roughly two-thirds of the population is in favor of the Arab League plan, normalization of relations within the international borders, basically the international consensus. But as usual, public opinion has almost no effect on policy. That's an interesting fact about American democracy. It's in fact a matter of principle. There's kind of principled reasons which go back to James Madison why that has to be the case. And it clearly is the case, and the public knows it. So about 95% of the public objects that public opinion is not taken into account by the government. But, you know, they're two-legged beasts, too. They don't really understand important things. That's part of the control. About the civilians popping out of holes, yeah, you can pull that straight out of Nazi propaganda, you know, British propaganda during the Revolutionary War, in fact, any imperial war. I mean, any invading imperial power would be delighted if resistance, if people who are resisting put on uniforms and stood out in an open field so they could be destroyed by overwhelming military force. And they get very upset when you know, Minutemen and others don't accept these rules. They should be wearing red coats like the Hessian soldiers, the British mercenaries. So sure, that's a standard. I mean, what's interesting is that I think you said Erlanger could even repeat such nonsense without collapsing in ridicule. About Iran, that's, you know, we don't know the details, but the reports are interesting. They do indicate two things. One, that the U.S. barred Israel from overflying Iraq, which would make it very difficult for them to attack Iran. The other aspect is that they apparently admitted that they're carrying out terrorist actions inside Iran. That's not the first time. There's been evidence of that for some time, including major terrorist acts from Pakistan and Afghanistan. But again, that's normal for an outlaw state. The lack of support for an Israeli attack is interesting. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that Israel does not want, that the United States does not want Israel to attack Iran. That could lead to a major conflagration with huge effects for American troops, for oil supplies, everything else. It wasn't much discussed, but there was a resolution, a congressional resolution, debated in the House, H.R. 362, I think it was, which called for the U.S. to, in effect, impose a blockade on Iran, you know, bar shipping in the Gulf and so on. It had enormous support. AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, was passionately in support of it and pulling out all the strings. It initially had overwhelming congressional support, but it was voted down. It was voted down in part thanks to lobbying by the anti-war movement, which is hardly a massive lobby in the United States. But it was voted down mainly because the U.S. government didn't want it. And the lobby consistently slinks away silently when it comes into conflict with U.S. power for good reasons. They know they haven't got a chance and they want to harm themselves. And this passed very calmly as well, many other such cases. As for Olmert, he did say, basically in his resignation speech, he had to resign because of charges of corruptions. So he resigned, and he's still in office, but basically resigned. And he did make a speech. It didn't make a speech. He had an interview in the press at that time in which he withdrew all of his earlier positions, all of them, and said that Israel must accept the international consensus, has to withdraw from the occupied territories, and maybe modification of borders, agreed upon, mutual modification agreed upon by both sides. In fact, he went back to essentially the Taba proposals, which, as I say, were almost realized, except that Israel blocked them at the end. That was his resignation speech. And it's interesting. It shows that he understood. And as you say, it was followed very shortly by rejection of possibilities of political settlement, crucial rejection several times, and the U.S.-Israeli invasion of Gaza, which is now underway. You can make of all of that what you want.
Professor Chomsky, you've almost entirely glossed over the numerous war crimes and violations of international law which have committed by Hamas, the ruling party in Gaza. These include this targeting of civilian populations by sending thousands of rockets into southern Israel, and Hamas's well-documented use of human shields by doing things like hiding their armaments in preschools, ambulances, and hospitals. I was wondering if you had a response to these crimes.
Yeah. Well, actually, I did talk about the first. As I pointed out, Hamas's targeting of Israeli civilian targets, yeah, those are criminal acts, as well as politically stupid. But and therefore, I think it would make good sense for us to stop our enormous military, diplomatic, and ideological support for Hamas. Okay, that's what we can do about it. Of course, these crimes, like Herschel Greenspan's or like those of the partisans during the Second World War, it didn't come out of nowhere. These are a reaction to ongoing Israeli crimes, not only in Gaza, but extensively in the West Bank. And those who have another proposal as to what Hamas ought to, as what resistance ought to take, do have a moral grounds to criticize those actions. Okay, just as those in Germany who were calling for an end to Nazi aggression, you know, they couldn't because they did kill, but we're free to do it here, would have had a justification in condemning the terrorism of the partisans. They didn't have a justification for supporting the Gestapo slogan, terror against terror. You commit terror, we'll commit worse terror. The only people in Germany who had a right to criticize the terror that they were attacking were those who were trying to stop the far greater atrocities of the Nazis, same with Kristallnacht, same with many other cases. The same with the American Revolution. I mean, the American, you know, the patriots, as we call them, we're terrorist forces. I mean, in those days, terrorism wasn't as extreme as it is today, nor was military conflict. But, yeah, it was serious. I mean, that's why the number of people who fled the colonies after independence was higher, or approximately the same, as the proportion of the population that fled Vietnam after the U.S. withdrew. They fled the terror of the victors. I mean, there were people fleeing from Boston Harbor, writing pathetic letters about how they were dying in the snow in Nova Scotia because they just had to get away from these terrorists who won the war. This is not a major theme of American history, but you can find the facts if you like. And they had good reason to, because, yes, the Nathaniel Green's forces, for example, were straight terrorist forces. And, of course, the British objected to this. How dare they hide, you know, in civilian places to shoot at our soldiers? As for the well-documented facts that you mentioned, the documentation is zero. The sole source for those claims is Israeli propaganda. Maybe it's true, you know, maybe it isn't. It's hard to imagine where you could hide in Gaza or live in Gaza, except near a civilian target. Israel, of course, does it all the time. So if you ask where the Israeli military command is, yeah, it's right in the middle of the cities. Where are they going to put it? So, sure, even though the documentation happens to be zero, not well documented, nevertheless, it's almost certainly true. And it offers no justification whatsoever for destroying the universities, destroying the schools, mental health clinics, attacking hospitals, shooting at ambulances, all the other crimes that you can read about if you want to bother looking. And the crimes are really serious. So, which I brought with me a report, which I have not seen reported in the American press, from the Gaza Water Utility. This is January 10th, a press release. They describe, I won't bother reading it, but they essentially describe how hundreds of thousands of people in Gaza are without water because of Israeli attacks on water systems and also attacks on sewage systems and, in fact, power plants, which make everything run, so that one discharging pond is leading to a major catastrophe that threatens the lives of thousands of people just by drowning in sewage flooding. Well, okay, sure some Israeli propagandist can tell you, yeah, there was a mortar hidden in the sewage system. Maybe there was. Does that have anything to do with these atrocities? Nothing, you know, for very simple reasons, the ones I mentioned. There is a right to resort to violence in self-defense if there are no alternatives. And in this case, there are very clear alternatives. Stop the criminal activities and accept the peace treaty. Okay? Not very hard. Stop your crimes, and that'll end the rocketing that you're concerned with.
Professor Chomsky, while this may seem obvious, because you've touched on it time and time again, why is it that the U.S. media appears to completely lap up the propaganda while appearing to not do any sort of objective journalism, which is what every single journalist student has, you know, studied to do? What in the world is going on?
Well, for one thing, I think, the U.S. media are just as good as any others. If I had one newspaper in the world to read, I couldn't read any other, I'd pick the New York Times, which is, you know, I don't love it, as you know. And the reporters themselves, not so much in the case of Israel, but in many cases, are courageous, honest. They report what's before their eyes, objective, if you like. But very typically, consistently, within a framework of interpretation that's subordinated to state corporate propaganda. That's unconscious. And it's true of the intellectual community generally. One of the reasons I write about the media is because it's easier to study the New York Times systematically than, say, to study academic scholarship systematically. That's a huge effort beyond my resources. But it's basically the same. You know, there aren't many differences. And it's the same in the general educated population. There is an assumption that the U.S. cannot do anything wrong. It can make mistakes, but can't do anything wrong. Individuals may do things wrong, like there may be a bad apple here and there, but we can't do anything wrong as a people. So take, say, the invasion of Iraq. Barack Obama is praised, even by the left, for what's called his principled opposition to the Iraq war. What was his principled opposition? Basically, we can't get away with it. He says it was a strategic blunder. Okay, you go back to Pravda in the 1980s when the Russians were invading Afghanistan. There are plenty of people saying it's a strategic blunder. We don't call that principled opposition to the war. After Stalingrad, there were plenty of Nazi generals who say, look, it was a strategic blunder to open a two-front war. Are they principled opponents of the Nazis? The very idea that this is called principled opposition is a very interesting insight into our own intellectual and moral culture. It's totally unprincipled. It's based on nothing except cost to us. Maybe there's a couple of words about, I don't like civilian casualties. But it's very hard to find any principled opposition in the culture, in the intellectual culture generally. And it's also true of things that go way back. So take the Vietnam War. There's been, reams of material on that. But try to find a principled criticism of it in the mainstream. If you look at the literature of, say, diplomatic history today, or anything that goes way back, you find two positions. They're the hawks, who say, with more force we could have won. And they're the doves, who say it was a lost cause, which was a mistake. Take Arthur Schlesinger, this leading American historian, Kennedy advisor, one of the most outspoken doves. He was a strong supporter of the war under Kennedy to the extent that he paid any attention to it at all. In fact, he paid almost no attention to it, even though Kennedy did directly attack South Vietnam and carried out many atrocities. But if you look in Schlesinger's journals, which just appeared, almost day-to-day record of everything he did, there isn't even a mention of Vietnam until the Johnson years. There's a lot about swimming pools and who jumped in naked and that sort of thing, but nothing about Vietnam. But by 1966, 67, he was, like others, becoming critical of the war. And he wrote a book which is considered one of the important criticisms of the war. It's called Bitter Heritage. And he was very explicit, you know, nothing hidden. He described his controversy with his friend Joseph Alsop, a major journalist who was a strong supporter of the war. And Schlesinger said something like this. She said, "We all pray that Mr. Alsop is right and that with more force, you know, the surge of the day, we will be able to win victory in a land of wreck and ruin with everything destroyed and so on and so forth. That's what we all pray, but it probably won't work." And then he said, if Mr. Alsop is right and we do win victory in this devastated land, we will all be praising the wisdom and statesmanship of the American government. And that wasn't ironic. He meant it, you know. And yes, that's the attitude of liberal doves. That's why when U.S. casualties decline in Iraq, you know, people say, well, you know, maybe it really was a success. Okay, killed 1 million people, and drove millions out of the country, destroyed the society, left it as a total ruin. Okay, but not too many American casualties. And the big problem is they're not doing what we say. You know, they're not. There is mass nonviolent resistance in Iraq. It's actually a major triumph of nonviolent resistance has compelled the invaders to back down from their, at least in words, we don't know if they'll live up to it, from their major goals. Okay, but who describes things that way? You know, where can you find a principled criticism? And this is not a critique of the press, because the press are reflecting the educated culture. They're reflecting the mentality of Harvard, MIT, you know, Yale, and so on. That's the culture from which they come. And I think the reporting is very accurate. In fact, a large part of what I've written is actually defense of the press for its professionalism and objectivity. You may know of a book that Edward Herman and I wrote called Manufacturing Consent, which is about the media. There's a lot of condemnation of the book, but nobody looks at it. This is material you're not allowed to look at. It doesn't keep the party line. But a large part of it, if anybody wants to look at it, is a detailed analysis of media coverage after the Tet Offensive. Tet Offensive is a crucially important event. After the Tet Offensive, Freedom House, you know, great defender of freedom, published two thick volumes denouncing the press for their lack of patriotism because they didn't report the Tet Offensive in a manner, you know, glorifying the United States sufficiently. You know, straight out of Stalinist Russia, that's Freedom House. Two volumes, one of commentary, one of documents. And they claimed the volume of commentary, you know, condemned the press for being on the side of the Viet Cong and hating America and, you know, all the usual stuff. And then there was the volume of documents that's supposed to back it up. Well, you know, I carried out the heinous act of actually reading the documents. The volume of documents completely refuted everything that they said in the volume of commentary, line by line. If you want details, look at the book. We went through it, and we concluded that contrary to the Freedom House Stalinist-style attack, the press was very courageous, competent, accurate. People described what they said, but entirely within the framework of U.S. doctrine, you know, U.S. propaganda. So, like, everything we're trying to do was right and noble, but, you know, we just had to destroy half the place because what choice do we have? But it's described accurately. Now, it's interesting that the media hated that defense of their objectivity and professionalism. They would much rather be portrayed the way Freedom House portrayed them in its Stalinist-style attack as traitors, you know, challenging authority, and so on and so forth. They like that. What they don't like is you're doing your job very competently and courageously, but you're completely subservient to propaganda and the party line. Nobody likes that. So that part of the book can't be read. But yeah, I think it's generally true. And I think those are the reasons. I mean, there are other reasons too, like the media, after all, are big corporations, you know, selling a product, audiences to other corporations, that surely has an effect, and so on.
You said a lot about sources that you've cited versus propaganda from various governments, and I imagine that a lot of the propaganda is written to look very similar to what you're citing as appropriate sources and to act like facts. And my question is, how do you personally differentiate between facts and facts? Like, how do you decide what you want to trust?
Are you an MIT student?
Yes.
Okay, so you've taken science courses.
Yes.
How do you decide what to believe? Mm-hmm. It's the same in this case.
You know, you don't believe every paper you see in the journals because some of them don't seem to make sense. And if they don't, you look back and see whether their data are correct and are the sources right. Was the doctor who wrote it in the pay of the drug companies and so on and so forth. Sure, and it's the same here. You just use the normal common sense that you use when you act as a scientist. I mean, it's a little different in the case of public affairs than science. I mean, Mother Nature is a hard taskmaster mistress, but she doesn't purposely put up barriers in the way of understanding, okay, as when you're reading, say, the press or academic work and so on. But it's pretty, on the other hand, it's a lot easier in the case of public affairs because it's all on the surface. You know, there's no theories to speak of. And try to find a theory in international relations theory. What's called a theory is laughable. You read just what's called just war theory. I could go through details if you like, but what it comes down to is I believe. You know, that's the way every argument runs. So it's all on the surface. Everything that I talked about today is on the surface. You can check it. It's just, you know, like bare data. If you don't think it's right, look it up. That's why I continually said verify it. Very simple. You'll find plenty of propaganda, like a couple of examples that I read. But you can also find the facts, and you can make your own mind. It's way easier than in the sciences in that respect, though harder in that you have to overcome barriers. But there's no special tricks. In fact, you know them all if you've taken science courses.
Professor Chomsky, good afternoon. In your opinion, what is the responsibility of the Arab League?
The responsibility of who?
The Arab League.
The Arab
countries,
League?
Particularly the neighboring countries like Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and even the oil-producing countries like Saudi Arabia. And going back to Lebanon, why do you think Hezbollah hasn't took any action, firm action yet, either like tactical action or, I mean, they just stuck to speeches. Thank you.
Well, with regard to Hezbollah, I mean, I'm not privy to their internal thinking, but I can guess that the reason they're not reacting is they know if they do, Lebanon gets turned into a charnel house. Remember, Israel has, I'll repeat what I said, armed and air forces greater, larger in scale, and technologically more advanced than any NATO power outside the U.S., and if they unleash it against Lebanon, okay. As for the Arab League, they've taken mixed positions. For example, Prince Turki al-Faisal, one of the leading figures in Saudi Arabia, and one of those considered the most moderate, you know, pro-American, he gave a very powerful speech at the Gulf Forum a couple of days ago, in which he bitterly condemned the U.S.-Israeli invasion, said we're all Palestinians now, if we have to martyr ourselves to defend the Palestinians, we should do it. Now, the governments aren't doing much, but exactly what are they supposed to do? I mean, they've got to control their own populations, which is hard. It's one of the reasons the U.S. sends them armaments, tons of armaments. And in fact, Israel has always been regarded as part of the defense of the ruling clerics against their populations. But first of all, they're not inclined to oppose U.S. power because they more or less agree with it for themselves. They have no use for the Palestinians, though the population does. And even if they wanted to do something, there's not much they could do. You know, it's pretty hard to stand up against the godfather. It is. International about the only theory I know of in international relations theory that's not trivial or obviously false, is that international relations is very much like the mafia. And the Godfather does not brook disobedience and has plenty of ways of reacting to it. And you take your fate in your hands if you do something like vote in an election the way the master doesn't want, you know, let alone interfere in some fashion. So, you know, I don't like their position at all, but it's pretty hard to blame them.
You mentioned one of the reasons for the strong U.S. support of Israel being the military base that they provide us in the Middle East, and it seems that the more support we give to Israel, the less secure the area really is, the less popular America seems to be in that region, and I don't know if there's a point at which our support of Israel will actually undermine our security. So my real question is, can you shed any more light on other reasons that America is so strongly allied with Israel?
Other places it's as strongly allied with?
No, other reasons that U.S. is so strongly allied with Israel besides it being just the best place to park our tanks.
Other reasons why Israel is
so supportive? Oh, I see.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it causes plenty of anti-American feeling among the population. But you know, nobody cares about that as long as they're under control. And that goes way back, long before U.S. support for Israel. I mean, U.S. support for Israel, as I mentioned, it was always there, but it became really strong. The alliance was really established in 1967. Well, 10 years before that, in 1958, which happened to be a pretty turbulent period there, President Eisenhower inquired with his staff. This is in secret. It's been public for a long time. He asked, why is there such a campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world, among the people, not the governments. The governments mostly go along with us. But why is there such a campaign of hatred against us among the people? That's George Bush's, why do they hate us? And there was a response. There was an analysis, which had just been produced by the National Security Council, the big highest planning council, which explained the reasons. It said there is a perception in the Arab world that the United States opposes democracy and development and supports tyrannies because the United States wants to get control of our energy sources. And it said, basically, the perception's correct, and that's what we ought to be doing. Okay, so there's a campaign of hatred against us, but as long as we've got what we want, what do we care? You know, I mean, back to the mafia, Don. I mean, maybe the people on the street hate him, you know, as long as he can run his affairs. Who cares about the two-legged beasts? You know? And that remains true. And Israel was not an issue at that time. But after 9/11, one newspaper, to its credit, the Wall Street Journal, did a study of opinions among Muslims. Not all Muslims, just the ones they cared about, what they called moneyed Muslims, like managers of, you know, multinational corporations and lawyers and people like that. This is after Bush's Why Do They Hate Us speech. And they did an analysis of what the opinion was, and they found the same answers, not opposition to, you know, globalization or capitalism, so-called capitalism or, you know, U.S. power or anything. In fact, they're right in the middle of it. It said that they found overwhelmingly pretty much what the NSC reported in 1958. They oppose U.S. support for brutal autocracies, its opposition to democracy and development, because of its interest to gain control of our resources. Now, by 2001, they added other reasons. One of them was U.S. involvement in a crushing of the Palestinians. And the second, another topic we're not allowed to talk about here, was the sanctions against Iraq, which were genocidal. You know, I mean, Clinton probably killed more Iraqis than Saddam Hussein, and they protested against that. Well, it's kind of like off the agenda here, but
she wanted to know what the reasons for U.S. support for Israel.
Well, I mentioned some of the reasons, so I'll just go over it again. One is it's a major military base. Two is what I quoted from U.S. intelligence back in 58. It's a logical corollary of U.S. opposition to Arab nationalism to support Israel as the only reliable base in the region. Third is it's very closely integrated with U.S. high tech. That's a big part of the U.S. economy. We ought to know that at MIT when Microsoft and HP and those guys are in love with Israel, that has an effect on policy. And, of course, they are in love with it, as you can just tell by investment patterns, for good reasons. You know, it's a nice relationship. Same in other respects. There's an ideological connection, especially among intellectuals, since 1967, since Israel's victory. There are other reasons that go sort of deep in the culture. What Israel's doing and has been doing resonates pretty well with our own history. I mean, the forcible and violent displacement of the two-legged beasts and settlement by a superior race, that's American history. Very explicit American history back to the 17th century, and very explicit. And the same is true of the providentialism. You look back over American history and American culture, a very strong theme, all right to the present, and including people who call themselves secular, is that everything that's happening is fulfilling God's will. God has a plan for the universe, and we're filling it. We're carrying out a mission by wiping out the indigenous population, by stealing their lands, by conquering half of Mexico, by invading Vietnam, whatever it may be. We're fulfilling the divine mission. That's providentialism. Very strong theme in U.S. culture all the way back. And it's very similar in Israel. If you read, the book that I mentioned, the book on the settlements, which is a very valuable book, one of its main, a lot of it is concerned with the thinking of the major groups of the settlers, the Gush Emunim, who are not marginal in Israel. In fact, they're highly honored as capturing the real essence of Israel and Zionism and what it is. And it's basically providentialist. By settling every inch of the land, we are carrying out God's will. We're bringing the Messiah. If you think Ahmadinejad is extreme, you ought to read American history and the ideology of the settlers. I don't know how to measure it, but I suspect that this resemblance between our own history, what we call our own history, and Israel's settlement, replacement of the two-legged beasts by a superior race, is probably significant. And incidentally, in the United States, it's not the right wing. You read this in Walt Whitman, for example, in Emerson, people like that. So there are plenty of reasons. I mean, they may not be good reasons, but they're certainly not insignificant. And when Israel goes against U.S. policy, the U.S. stops them, of course. The case I mentioned about attacking Iran is one, but there are many others.
Dr. Chomsky, I'm Jim Schneider. I sell the Herald and the Globe in front of a donut shop in Bunker Hill Mall in Charlestown. I was wondering if you had a chance to notice the October 6th article in the Oil and Gas Journal, which describes the delineation of some supergiant oil fields off the coast of Israel. And they also say that it's an arc that goes from Syria, follows the coast of Israel, and then goes over to Egypt. And what's kind of embarrassing is to look at this full-colored chart on the first page, and there's a nice deposit of higher-quality condensates under Gaza. But there's no reference in the article that the Palestinian Authority is going to have any access to whatever monies are derived from what offshore territorial rights they would have. I guess evidently they don't have any, because if you can have the Israeli Navy off the coast, well, you probably can't have your own oil field business. But they found 15 billion barrels of oil and 100 trillion cubic feet of gas so far. But nobody seems to mention it. You know, it's about rockets, and it's about who killed whose kids first. It's not about dirty old oil, especially if it's a hell of a lot of it.
Yeah, I'm kind of skeptical. I didn't read that article, but there has been reporting, but there are plenty of studies about that, and it's been known for a long time that there are a gas and oil, mostly gas, I think, as you said, mostly gas. Resources off the coast of Gaza, not much off of Israel, or they would have exploited it. But I frankly doubt that that has much to do with what's going on. I mean, suppose that the United States stopped its rejectionism and permitted a weak, defenseless, unarmed Palestinian state to survive in accord with the national consensus. They'd have no trouble getting that oil. They don't have to let Israel conquer it to do. In fact, they'd probably get it more easily from a Palestinian state than from Israel, which is strong enough to have its own interests. So I doubt very much that that's a factor in what's going on.
Professor Chomsky, given the fact that there are dozens of schools in the Boston area and at least over 100,000 students that could pretty easily organize themselves, would you support an area divestment campaign, divesting university and college funds in those businesses that are doing business with Israel on the model of a South African anti-apartheid divestment campaign?
And I'm not hearing very well, I'm afraid.
Would you support a divestment campaign publicly on the model of the South African
anti-apartheid? South African boycott? Yeah.
Well,
That analogy is brought up a lot, but I'd urge you to pay some serious attention to the South African boycott. It was important, and it had an effect, but look at when it had an effect. There was an academic boycott of South Africa back in the 60s, but on very narrow grounds, because the universities were excluding blacks. Okay, so it didn't want to support racist universities. But that doesn't work in this case. The real boycott that, began to be a mass movement with effects was mostly in the 1980s. That was after decades of serious education and organizing. It was at a time when American business was publicly opposed to apartheid, congressional resolutions were condemning apartheid, when mayors were getting arrested, protesting this and that. By the time you had really mass public opposition to apartheid, yes, then you could have a boycott movement. But that preliminary work has not been done. And a call for a boycott is a tactical move. It's not a principled move. It's a tactic, You have to ask what its consequences are. And I think if you think through the consequences before you've done the work, the educational and organizing work, that'd probably backfire. It'll be just, screams about anti-Semitism or support for Israeli atrocities and so on. So take a look at the history. It's worth looking at. Incidentally, by the 80s, it did get to the point where Congress passed legislation barring U.S. trade with South Africa. That's very different from where we are now, where Congress almost unanimously supports every Israeli atrocity that comes along, with Dennis Kucinich and two other people voting against it. Also, it's worth remembering that the Reagan administration violated the congressional legislation, and in fact trade with South Africa increased after the legislation. And at the peak of the administration, that's Reagan, Colin Powell, and the rest, as late as 1988, just right before the collapse of apartheid, the U.S., the Pentagon, Powell's Pentagon, declared that the African National Congress was one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. That's Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress in Colin Powell's Pentagon, 1988. In fact, Mandela was on the terrorist list until a couple of months ago. They finally took him off because the African National Congress was a terrorist organization. And it did carry out terror, undoubtedly. And I don't know the South African literature, but I'm sure they condemned it for, hiding in public places and not standing out in a field with uniforms so they could be shot down, and so on and so forth. So, yes, I think it's something to think about, but also to think about. See, in fact, if we could ever get to the point where you had enough activism and organization to even think about a boycott, you could do something much simpler. Get the U.S. to join the international consensus, as the majority of the population already wants them to do. Then, talk about boycotts. So I don't think it's it just doesn't seem to me like a sensible tactic. It's quite apart from any question of principle.
Professor Jomsky, I just had a two-part question. The first part of the question is, what exactly is the planned outcome, is Israel's planned outcome after the recent bombings and recent action against the Gaza Strip and post-invasion? Are they really after just disarming Hamas's military wing, or do they have a complete coup planned? And also, my second question is, where could people find reliable death tolls and information about destruction in Gaza and in Israel? Because I see, a variety of numbers being thrown around about how many thousands of rockets are launched into Israel, but I never see much of a death toll associated with the thousands of rockets. I'm not sure really what their capacity is, and some people say that they're resembling of bottle rockets. I don't know. But I'd like to know more about them, and I'd like to see if there is legitimately collateral damage in being, conducted in Palestine, or if it is, in fact, overkill.
Well, I don't think there's any question that it's massive overkill. I mean, just look at the official casualty figures in the current invasion. The latest I saw, it's coming close to 1,000 Palestinians, which is almost undoubtedly an underestimate, because they don't count people who die because, they starve or can't get water or can't get to a hospital and so on. And I think, I think there's maybe a half a dozen Israeli soldiers or something like that, some of them killed by friendly fire. I mean, you can't talk about overkill, we're out of that league. For reliable information about the questions you're asking, the best place I know to look is in the major Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem, which has regular publications in English, pamphlets. You can find them on the web. B'Tselem. And they give very judicious, careful analyses of everything that's going on. As to the numbers killed by the rockets in the last years, I forget the exact number, maybe a dozen or something like that. It's just, these, but you can find them. And as for numbers of rockets, well, you can find them too. Like I quoted the figure 7,700 shells attacking northern Gaza before the onslaught June 2006. That comes from Human Rights Watch. And, they do analysis. You want information on white phosphorus? It's coming from Human Rights Watch, which tends to be pretty supportive of Israel, incidentally, although they do good work. But B'Tselem is the best source I know. As to Israel's plans, well, in my view, I told you what I think about the reasons for the invasion, and I presume, if that's correct, that the plans are to make those reasons work. The plan is to get quiet, peace and quiet, quiet of the graveyard if it has to be, which will enable Israel to carry out its criminal acts on the West Bank with U.S. support and without any interference. I presume that's the plan.
Thanks.
Thank you, Noam.
Yep.
Thank you.
Professor Noam Chomsky addressing the crisis in Gaza at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology on Tuesday, January 13th. This program was sponsored by the MIT Center for International Studies. Audio recording by Chuck Urozina. Thanks for listening.